From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This may be hard to believe, but the very first conviction for the crime of genocide came less than 20 years ago. In 1998, an international tribunal convicted Jean-Paul Akayesu. He was the mayor of a town in Rwanda when the violence erupted in 1994. A million people died. Leading the prosecution was a 32-year-old man, the son of Haitian immigrants, Pierre Richard Prosper. Prosper said there was no precedent to go by, no one to talk to for advice, lots of theories, but no actual experience with a case like this. So he had to work from the ground up. And in the end, he got his conviction. Prosper lives in Salt Lake City these days. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about that case and the others in his life that have imbued him with a deep sense of justice. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, try and imagine the scene. This is the late 1990s in Rwanda. The country was still reeling from the brutal violence in 1994 when a million people were killed over the course of 100 days. Tens of thousands of women had been raped. The UN had just started this process of trying to prosecute the genocide, but it didn't have that much in place. Pierre Richard Prosper had been put in charge of the prosecution. He was only, I think, 32 at the time. And he said things in Rwanda were a mess. There was no precedent for a case like this, so he had no one to talk to, except maybe diplomats or scholars, and they could only offer theories, no real experience. So Prosper says without any rules, without any real process, he told his team they were going to improvise, to make it up as they went along. And so they did. And along the way, they created this international process, and they got their precedent, the first conviction for the crime of genocide. This was in September of 1998. Today in the program, Pierre Richard Prosper is joining us to tell that story and others. He's led a pretty remarkable life, and it just so happens he lives in Salt Lake City these days. He's joining us here in the studio. He's a partner at the law firm of Arendt Fox. He was a deputy district attorney for Los Angeles County, where he was a prosecutor on the hardcore gang unit there. We'll talk about that. He also served as the second United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues under President George W. Bush, and he's here in the studio. And Mr. Ambassador, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
I guess I want to begin in the late 90s. When did you first go to Rwanda? I guess let's begin there. What was it, 96, 97?
Yeah, well, I actually first went to Rwanda in 95.
To write this report.
To write a report for the Department of Justice and the U.S. government. The idea at the time was the United States wanted to figure out what it could do in response to the genocide. The U.N. had already decided to create an international criminal tribunal at the end of 94, but the U.S. wanted to decide what its role was.
Yeah.
So I went there for about a five-week mission, wrote a report which was circulated in Washington.
Wait, back up. So talk about the day you touched down in Rwanda.
Well, I remember that very first time on that short trip, obviously having anxiety and being nervous. It was my first time in Africa. I was actually going into a war zone where a million people had been killed.
Yeah. This was 95. This wasn't that far past that experience.
No, that's right. That's right. It was under a year.
Yeah.
And, I remember flying in from Brussels. And the flight was pretty sparse, pretty empty. And we were diverted. Instead of going straight to Rwanda, we had to land in Entebbe. And when we're sitting on the plane, everyone was nervous, wondering, okay, what's going on? There were rumors swirling already that the conflict had erupted again. So we sat down. We were in Entebbe for a few hours and finally got back on the plane and landed into Rwanda, which was, filled with fog and literally, the stench of death was still in the air.
Literally.
Literally. I remember walking down the street with a UN human rights person, and the wind blew in our direction. I got this pungent odor, and I said, well, what is that? And the person told me it's a smell of decaying bodies.
And you saw them along the way?
Yeah. We saw, you know, it's horrific. Yeah. You know, I had seen, you know, dead bodies before as a gang prosecutor in L.A., but they were sanitized. Mm-hmm. Here you could see them in an unsanitized manner. I remember going to one of the churches, Niemata, that we drove out to. It was a horrific sight where 10,000 people were killed. And when I arrived there, you had to cover your face because the odor was so bad. Flies were flying around. The bodies were still in the church covered with blood-soaked clothes. And, you know, it was one of those things where it truly shocked the conscience. Mm.
What was the report you were supposed – what were you trying to learn? Or what did the United States want you to report on?
Yeah. Well, so – you know, at the time, what we knew, the world knew, was a genocide had occurred. Yeah. And the United Nations decided that it was going to establish an international criminal tribunal to go after the leaders and the orchestrators and the organizers of the genocide. The United States government, obviously supporting the UN, decided, well, what else can we do?
Yeah.
What can we do at a local level? Because if you think about a million people being killed in 100 days, by the ways of machetes, clubs, and so on, there are a lot of perpetrators. It would be impossible for the United Nations to prosecute all those people, so we needed to look at domestic approaches. And that was my job, was to go into Rwanda to see what the United States government could do to assist a local process to help, spread the rule of law.
When they saw your report... And maybe you're too modest to say, but they were pretty impressed by it. They were pretty impressed by the work that you had done. How do you describe what you said in the report that led them basically led you to become this chief prosecutor for the UN? I mean, what were you seeing? What was the analysis that helped you think about all of this?
Well, you know, I haven't looked back at that report in a long time, but I remember the overriding conclusion was, you know, they need everything.
Yeah.
And I toured the country for 5 weeks. I spoke with, ministers of justice, victims, survivors. I spoke with police, potential prosecutors. And it was clear to me that there was a dearth of resources, and both human and physical resources. And this is what I tried to convey in the report, and I tried to convey some ideas as far as, you know, what could we do. And one of the things I remember thinking of, and it became clear to me at that time, was I started to understand what justice meant at that point. Meaning, when we... You know, living here in the United States, we think of justice, we think of courts, we think of all the bells and whistles that are associated with that. At that moment, I remember thinking, you know, justice is really about the people. And all we need is a table, chairs, and maybe a pencil and paper. And then of course, the individuals to begin to administer the justice.
Wait, what do you mean? Because you mean, by that you mean... Justice is about the stories that we need them to tell.
Well, justice is the stories that we need them to tell, and justice is about the community holding people accountable or acquitting them, coming to a resolution. We don't need all the sophisticated apparatus that we have here. Mm-hmm. And once I came to that conclusion, it was liberating. So writing the report, it was pretty straightforward, saying, look, here's what we need to do. We need to support and train, you know, individuals. We need just a few basic things to get the process moving. We don't need any high-tech equipment. You don't need a lot of the sophistication that we're accustomed to, the complex rules of evidence and procedure.
Yeah.
We just really need impartial triers of fact that can listen and come to a just conclusion.
Boy, that idea of the people... that being the basis of justice, was that a light bulb moment for you in some way?
Yeah, it was, you know, because before I had been a deputy district attorney, I also was a federal prosecutor for a while, and you're conditioned in our system to look to the books first, to look to the codes, to look at the laws, and that in a way the people are second, the jury, the judges, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. But this was a light bulb because it made me realize that, you know, we have it wrong. You know, you start with the people, the rules, the codes, and so forth are there to assist, not to necessarily dictate a process.
When it was presented to you, when they said, okay, Pierre Richard, we want you to be the chief. You were 32 at the time, yeah?
Yes.
When they said, we want you to take over this international effort, like this is the first time there had, and this is the thing I want you to maybe mention, there had been no prosecution for the defined term of genocide anywhere.
That's right. So the Genocide Convention was passed in 1948 in response to World War II.
Right.
So you had the creation of the United Nations, and one of the first acts was to pass the Genocide Convention. It was, as I said, in response to Nazi Germany and what happened. It remained dormant for 50 years. You know, despite all the conflicts that we've heard about, you've read about, it remained dormant until we essentially had to dust it off in starting in 96, but ultimately the conclusion of the trial was 1998. So when we looked at it, it was theories and principles.
Yeah.
You know, we'd read what academics wrote. We'd read what the diplomats had to say at the time. We read what Raphael Lemkin, the person who coined the term genocide, wrote, and what he believed it to mean. And we basically had to take that, interpret it, and apply it to the facts at hand. So now when I was asked to take on this job...
How did you respond?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote the report, and a week later, I already knew my name was in the mix. So a week later, Janet Reno's office calls me and says, we really want you to be the U.S. prosecutor assigned to the tribunal.
This is the Attorney General, Janet Reno. Everyone knows that recently died. Yeah,
yeah. And then I told him I'll call you in a week. You know, I needed to think about it.
You didn't jump at it.
I didn't jump at it.
Why?
Well, I just came back, and it was obviously a mind opening experience. It was horrific to the eyes and the soul.
Yeah.
I had to think about. Now it'd be a commitment for a year or perhaps more. I had to think about what it meant as far as career path, because keep in mind these tribunals were new, and when I mean new, they were non-existent new.
Yeah.
No, there was no one I could speak with to say, well, when you do this, where does it take you? What is the path?
What doors does this open up?
Yeah,
no
what
one,
doors?
Who knows? This is the first time.
In fact, most of my colleagues thought I was crazy. I said, no, you don't want to do that. You'll be taking yourself off the normal track as a lawyer to be whatever it may be, a partner in a firm, a judge, or whatever it may be. And I remember thinking after a while, deliberating and speaking with friends that, you know, a year in a lifetime is nothing. And I would have a lifetime of regret if I didn't do this. And here, the worst case scenario, even if it were a miserable experience, it would be a growing experience.
Yeah.
So I decided to take it. And then when I arrived...
Did part of that feel like a commitment to the people you had seen? Like, was there that... Did you feel like almost morally you had to in some way?
Yeah, I did. I felt invested at that point.
Yeah.
And I felt that, you know, it was harder to say no. But still, you know, when you're back... I'm now back in Los Angeles.
Right.
I'm living on the beach.
Yeah.
And... You know, I remember just looking out at the, you know, the sunset, and you're thinking, wow, do I really want to do this?
Yeah.
And literally leave my comfort zone, give up everything, put things in storage, leave friends and family. And it was at a time that before we had, you know, the internet, email, and so forth. So you're really disconnecting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally decided that, you know, it's something that I needed to do.
When you had a team together, what did you say to them? Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, one of the first meetings where you have everyone in place and you're like, okay, mm-hmm. guys, we don't have any precedent to go on. Here's our plan. What were you thinking in those early days? And what were you telling the people you were guiding and directing?
Well, it was a little more, even more complicated, believe it or not, because when I first arrived, initially I was to be the second chair. Yeah. There was a senior trial attorney who was 53, and then the deputy prosecutor was a 73-year-old man from Madagascar. The chief prosecutor was based in The Hague. So I was supposed to be the essentially the second chair. But once we got there, it became very apparent that the senior trial attorney and the number two, the deputy prosecutor, were did not have the experience, to put it kindly.
Yeah.
And the tribunal was going in the wrong direction, not only from an organizational perspective, but also substantively in trying to prepare these cases. So I remember bringing the team together and decided to start a shadow preparation process, you know, outside the purview of the leadership. And I got the team together and said, look, this is what we need to do. We're improvising, as we discussed.
Yeah.
Let's build the case this way. So we began to do this in a parallel process, meanwhile receiving instructions from the other two. And then probably within, 3 months of being on the ground, the chief prosecutor came down from The Hague, Judge Louise Arbour from Canada, and she realized it was a mess and came to me and said, Pierre, you know, if I put you in charge, can you do this? And I told her that I could. And she made the decision in earlier fall of 96 to put me in charge of the process. And ultimately, the deputy and the senior trial attorney were terminated, and I took over the process.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the sort of the landscape at the time, and we need to talk about Jean-Paul Kayessou. He is really powerful figure. He's the mayor of the Taba district in central Rwanda. He's a former school teacher. He was a popular guy. I mean, he was he played soccer, was popular that way. He was thought to be a man of integrity, sort of a reluctant politician at best. I mean, and he had this kind of, how do you describe the kind of power, I guess, that he had?
Yeah. You know, in Rwanda and really in many countries in the developing world, a mayor is probably the most powerful governmental figure, because he, and it was all he's at the time,
yeah,
is closest to the people. He was someone that the community would go to, for any problem, whether it's domestic, within a family, whether it was health care, education, neighborly disputes. They would go to the mayor hat in hand with great deference and ask him to solve their problems. So it was an authoritative figure that everyone looked up to as the wise person. So when you wield that kind of influence, it can go both ways. You can obviously have a positive impact on people's lives, but you can also direct people to engage in whatever action you think is appropriate. And what we saw here in Rwanda is Kayessou, who was very charismatic, a good-looking man, a sharp man, made the decision to use his influence in this negative way to pursue genocide.
Did you, as you were sort of putting together this case and trying to figure out what had happened, at least with the mayor, was there sort of a tipping point for him when he crossed over? Had he been inclined against the Tutsi population? I mean, were you able to sort of construct a story for the way? I mean, he ultimately came to influence thousands and thousands of people to commit these horrible murders. But was there a turning point that you could identify?
Yeah, there was. You know, initially, you know, many people thought the Kayessou case was a loser case, because in the beginning part of the genocide, Kayessou actually protected his population. And part of it, one of the things that we ultimately figured out, I had to come to the answer, so, well, why did this happen? Why did he turn?
Yeah.
And a couple things came to light. One is the realization of genocide, meaning genocide is not committed, for the most part, simply out of ethnic hate. I came to the realization, we came to the realization that there's a political motivation or drive behind it. And mm-hmm. and you look at whether it's Milosevic, Hitler, whomever, there's always politics associated.
Like an ideology.
Yeah. And it's mm-hmm. it's a way of obtaining and keeping power.
Power, yeah.
So Akayesu was in the South as a Southern Hutu. So there was a North-South rift among the Hutus who are responsible for the genocide. And at first he was protecting the population, wondering, and this is a theory that we put forward, wondering whether this was the North trying to take control of the country and they were also going to go after the Southern Hutus, or was it a true genocide against the Tutsi population? He finally came to the conclusion that it was a true genocide, went to a meeting on April 18th, basically 2 weeks after the genocide started, heard his party leader say, we need to put aside our political differences, come together, fight the common enemy, the Tutsi. And it was after that day he went back to his community and held his own meeting, saying the same thing, and launched the genocide in full course in that area.
He was all in at that point.
He was all in.
The other dynamic about all of this, I mean, if you, let alone the horrible sort of bludgeoning to death and the machete murders and all of that, were the rapes.
Yes.
And it seemed like not just sort of random rapes in the chaos of war, but it was almost systemic. Is that accurate to say?
It is. It was systematic. And it became part of the tool of destruction. It was a way of not only belittling the population, but torturing the population. So when a particular ethnic group, in this case the Hutus, is trying to destroy the other group, it is a means or a vehicle of destruction. So if you can combine that with the killing, you combine it with the rape and sexual violence, you can see what kind of impact it has on an ethnic group. It really destroys them. While the group may still be in physical existence, mm-hmm. at least in part, they no longer contribute to society in a meaningful way after having husbands, fathers, brothers, children killed, sisters, mothers, themselves sexually violated in horrific manner. You know, you're left as a walking dead. You know, and I remember seeing some of these victims and talking with them at the time, where they were physically alive, but when you looked into their eyes, there was a depth, and that depth was filled with emptiness and sorrow, and you could only imagine what is this person thinking, because in this case, the she was not vocalizing her feelings.
Yeah.
There was no outward expression that you could point to say, okay, this must be what she's going through. It was just, as they say, a living dead, walking zombie, where this person would just look at you and just stare at you, blankly.
So how is it then, if you have these people who have been traumatized beyond even the word, how do you convince them to be a witness in mm-hmm. a trial? How do you convince them to say something?
Yeah. You know, we had many, many challenges. And the first challenge we had was bringing back confidence and credibility to the United Nations. Because the United Nations, before the start of the genocide, was there with 5,000 peacekeepers. As the genocide started on April 6th of 1994, the Security Council, which includes our government, made the decision to pull out the peacekeepers, leaving a shell group of 500 there. And literally, these peacekeepers were pulling away and watching the massacres take place as they were pulling away.
Yeah.
So now we came back and said, hey, we're United Nations. We're here.
Yeah, so they're not going to trust you.
No. So we had to really just begin, and it kind of goes back to my earlier point is about the human being.
Yeah.
We had to make this a human process.
Yeah.
And really connect. And I remember with many of these victims and survivors, more often than not, I would go visit them and spend time with them and not even talk about what happened to them. It's just really building the relationship and slowly with each visit, inching forward to the ultimate goal. Now, there were smart people. They knew why
you
I was
knew
there.
Why you were there. Yeah, yeah.
But you know, we had to establish the trust and the confidence, and ultimately get to the point. And it wasn't easy. Mm. You know, it wasn't easy. In fact, when
it mattered to them that you cared about them and talked to them.
It mattered. It mattered that not only talk, that we listened,
yeah,
even if it was nonverbal communication, which for the most part it was, but that you were there, that you listened, you appreciated their concerns, their fear, their anxiety, their trauma. And then I think with that, it started to build a bit of the trust to say, okay, we will move forward with you.
Do you remember the first one, the first witness you were able to convince to come forward?
I do, because you know, we had a list of witnesses and some preliminary statements from them that we could draw from. But when the trial was due to begin in January of 1997, in December of 1996, there were some attacks, and we had a witness killed. Along with his daughter and nine other people in Taba, in Akayesu's community. And it was designed to intimidate.
Sure.
So we lost all our witnesses. And I remember it was 3 days before the trial was to start. I had to go back down to Taba. And keep in mind, the tribunal was set up in Arusha, Tanzania.
Yeah.
We did that for a neutral zone.
And Hague was way too far away.
Hague was too far away. It was announced. CNN, BBC, everyone was going to be there. It was 3 days away, and I had no witnesses. And we had to go back, and we identified the three witnesses that we wanted to start with. And I remember being literally in the bush at night in someone's home, which is, you know, basically a, you know, hut-style home, no electricity, candlelight. There'd been attacks that had been occurring there in that community. And I'm sitting there looking at this woman saying, hey, you know, will you testify? And trying to persuade her and her husband to let her go. And I remember also I was there with a colleague, but outside the house, I remember seeing a soldier, you know, walking by with an AK-47 patrolling because there had been insurgents. And I remember thinking, like, what am I doing? I mean, literally, we're there by candlelight, and it was pitch black. And she finally said she would do it. And once she said she would do it, it allowed the second person to come. And we started with three witnesses, took a break, and then people saw, okay, this is possible, and it started to build momentum. And it goes back to the point we were talking about, improvising. I didn't have everyone lined up. We were literally piecing it together as we went along.
Pierre Richard Prosper is with us. He's a lawyer, former L.A. County District Attorney, former war crimes prosecutor in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. He's joining us today. We'll need to take a break, but we'll come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the remarkable life of Pierre Richard Prosper. He's an attorney, lives here these days, the son of Haitian immigrants. He's had some important assignments over the years. He prosecuted gang murders in L.A., went after Colombian drug lords. The task that we're talking about was as a war crimes prosecutor, the chief war crimes prosecutor for the U.N., sorting through the horrific violence that erupted in Rwanda in 1994. Prosper's work in Rwanda is the subject of a documentary that played in Salt Lake City not so long ago. He's joining us today to talk about all of this in the studio. I wanted to ask you about growing up. You were raised in various places, New York, among them your parents, Haitian immigrants, of course. You spent not much time, I guess, in Haiti, or did you?
Yeah, well, I was born in the States, and after I was my younger sister was born, we moved back to Haiti, lived right there for a few years. But after moving up to New York, we would go back and spend, you know, I would say half the summers in Haiti through high school. It was important to my parents, and they were right, I have to say, that they instilled the culture in us so that we understood, not only where they came from, where we came from, understood family traditions and so on.
Your parents were in Haiti during the regime of Baby Doc Duvalier. And I'm wondering what sort of influenced the sort of limitation mm-hmm. on freedom of speech, which to you seems pretty important in the scheme of things, and we'll sort of come back to that. But what sort of influence did that have, do you think, as you look back on it now and the way you thought about justice, when you thought about the things that you've done in your life, including your experiences in Rwanda?
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting question because, you know, growing up as an American, you are instilled with an understanding of what your rights are.
Yeah.
And you have the right to free thought, free speech, free expression, and so on. And it's unquestioned. And I remember that, you know, growing up, particularly in a dual culture society, this is something that I embraced, and this is why people come to America, to be able to exercise their rights. So as a child, I remember specifically one instance of being in Haiti. It was under Baby Doc Duvalier, and I made a comment to my older cousin about the president's appearance. I forget exactly what it was, but I remember she quickly grabbed me, pulled me aside, and said, "Shh, don't say that. You'll get in trouble." You know, they're... It was as though, you know, the secret police was around. The Tonto Macu would take me away, and I would disappear at night. And I remember just, you know, being puzzled by that, just trying to get your mind around it. It's really, why can't I say that?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're young, so you don't fully understand it. But it was a realization that the world is not monolithic in its views, and that there are different views on rights and process, I guess.
This idea of freedom of speech you've talked about as the trial began in Rwanda. One of the things that I think you've talked about, I guess, learning along the way was once you see freedom of speech start to slip in a regime, in a country, and
yes.
a community, you can start to tolerate a lot of terrible things. Is that one of the takeaways?
It is. You know, the problem that we have today, and even past several decades, is the world will look at basic human rights violations, whatever it may be, freedom of speech, you know, the right to vote, education, health, whatever it may be. And you see it chipping away, and we start saying, "Oh, gee, that's bad. It's a shame." And when we look the other way, and next thing you know, you wake up and you see wherever it is that there are these atrocities occurring, and you're like, "Well, how did we get here?"
Yeah.
Well, it's easy to see because a genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, whatever it may be, does not happen overnight. It starts with the slippage. It starts with the basic breakdown of fundamental human rights. And it may be arbitrary detention. It may be the denial of free speech. It may be rigged elections, whatever it may be. But slowly it builds and builds to a tipping point where that particular society can move to that next level. So what I always try to advocate is, we need to pay attention to these early warning signs. They are not insignificant. They may seem insignificant in comparison to death, but they're not insignificant as it relates to the rule of law and democracy.
So when you look at conflicts going on now in the in the world, I guess you're thinking about what were the signs that we should have spotted along the way, dealt with then, so we're not having to deal with it now?
Exactly. I you know, I'm of the school of thought, and maybe this is, you know, too optimistic or idealistic, but I think everything is preventable. As long as we pay attention and we act early, And when you look at all these conflicts, you can see the buildup. And it's due to a lack of political will, or it's due to people thinking or hoping that a certain issue will go away, that it's ignored, and then finally it gets to that point where it tips. If you look at, you know, for example, today we're concerned about, you know, ISIS and so on and their activities. Well, you know, the warning signs were there. You know, the warning signs were there early on in many ways, and they were very apparent when they began to behead people, you know, five plus years ago. And we obviously were outraged and said, well, they'll be brought to justice, but then there was no real concrete action. And now today we're in a situation where they are a force. They're kidnapping girls, raping women. They're committing a genocide against the Yazidi population. Yeah. And it happened all before our eyes.
You know, it's interesting. One of the takeaways from your experience in Rwanda was, as you said, just going and being with people. Is that part – could that have been part of the sort of diplomatic effort or the effort here, getting people on the ground, not just with weapons, mm-hmm. but to establish trust again and to have conversations with people?
Well, I think so, and I think when I think about what we could be doing as a nation, or what any nation could be doing, I don't jump to the military solution. I mean, sometimes it is what it is, and you have to use force. But really, a lot of these preventive measures that we're talking about are pure engagement, and it may be diplomatic, it may be community engagement, business engagement, Peace Corps, you know, whatever it may be, working with civil society. It's all those little things that begin to strengthen these communities and strengthen the rule of law at the local level. A lot of it may be economic issues, because I think if you look around the world in many of these places, if they're economically strong, It in a way provides security. People are less likely to rebel or be attracted to calls for violence, and those are the things we need to be thinking about. So just pure, you know, basic engagement.
When did it occur to you to go to law school, by the way? Like, one of the things you've mentioned to us was this idea of justice, trying to figure out what justice is, mm-hmm. and trying to sort of get toward justice was one of the things that sort of got you there. What were you thinking about in those early days?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, after graduating from Boston College, I ended up taking a year off, and it wasn't a planned gap year. It was really that I had no idea what I wanted to do. Yeah. I was lost. I was waiting tables, and I sold insurance for a while. And then finally, after speaking with my brother-in-law and then the head of the lacrosse team I was playing for at the time, the club.
What did you play,
team,
by the way?
I was a midfielder.
Midfielder,
yeah.
Okay, midi, all right.
Yeah, and still am. I still play.
Okay,
actually.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
A lot slower, but yeah. And he was the head of the club, was a lawyer as well. And I remember talking with him, and then it started to dawn on me. Well, yeah, maybe I'll go to law school. And it wasn't anything that was clear in my mind, but it was something like, okay, this may be a path. And I was still trying to formulate all of my thoughts as to what I wanted to do and what my role in the world was. And it wasn't until I actually got to law school, and my second year I clerked for the district attorney's office, that the light bulb went off, and promoting justice was something that I wanted to do.
You're at Pepperdine, so it was the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office.
Yes.
It's so interesting that you ended up as a prosecutor, mm-hmm. not a defense attorney. Or
yes.
A public. How did you figure you could – which is not to say prosecutors aren't interested in justice, but yeah. I would have thought that in – did you consider the defense, the public defender part, or did you think, no, the prosecution part is where I can get this justice that I'm thinking about?
I did. During my third year of law school, I had offers with law firms, the public defender's office, and the district attorney's office, and it came down to the public defender or the DA's office, and I decided that I could do more justice, I guess, as a prosecutor than a defense attorney. Because as a defense attorney, you're at the mercy of the system. And you're at the mercy of the prosecutor or the judge or the jury, for that matter. And if they are against you, the only thing you can do is fight and hope that you can prevail. As opposed to the prosecutor,
you're in control.
You're in control. And you can do what is in the interest of justice. You can dismiss a case or you can pursue a case with full vigor. Even if you're going to lose, and you know you're going to lose, sometimes you need to put the defendant or the case through the paces and let the jury decide. So I knew I had more range of tools available to me to administer justice as a prosecutor.
What was going on in Los Angeles in the late 80s when you were there? This was really sort of the height of gang violence.
Yeah, it was. Out of control.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to really put it into context, but we were, you know, I think just in LA city alone, we're averaging well over, 1,000 gang related murders a year easily.
Wow.
And then, countless attempted murders and assault and batteries and you name it. It was crazy. We had the LA riots. I was working in Inglewood, then down in Compton, and then
so you're in the heart of it.
I was in the heart of it.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it was not uncommon for me, particularly when I was in Compton, to drive to work in the morning and see yellow tape on the side of the road encircling a body that someone died from gang violence that night. It was just a regular occurrence. And in fact, when I in my last years in the DA's office, I handled only murder cases. And I remember before I left the DA's office to become a federal prosecutor, I had to transfer to my colleagues my caseload, which was 22 cases. And they were all murder, double murder, and triple murder cases. And that's just me. And I was one of 50 in the hardcore gang unit. So we were a specialized unit that covered the whole county.
So you had to go into these places, and there were moments. I'm wondering if you had any flashbacks when you were in Rwanda, to going into these basically war torn places in Los Angeles and talking to witnesses and convincing them to come forward. Was it the same kind of process as getting a witness in Rwanda to come forward?
You know, I would say yes. You know, obviously the environment's completely different.
Of course,
but
the scale is different.
Yeah.
All of that,
but it's the same. And I think what it was they seeing you leave. You know, you're I'm using the word again, comfort zone,
yep.
And coming to them to talk to them and encourage them to come forward. I remember my first murder case when I was a baby DA, probably 3 years in. And I got a murder case, and my main witness was an original gangster,
an OG,
OG, yeah. And I had to go meet him in a park in Watts.
Wow!
And I think this is probably 92, whatever it is. And I remember I went with the sheriff detective, and he said, "Look, I'm going to be sitting over here. You need to walk into that park and sit on that bench, and he's going to come." And talk with you. And it was some guy I'd never met before. And, this guy rolls up with a limp because he'd been shot 5 times in the back by the person I'm about to prosecute for murder, for killing his friend. And he just got out of state prison. And I think the fact that I sat there and talked with him, spent whatever amount of time with him, it worked, and he finally, he tried to explain to me that he didn't want to testify, that he's going to take care of this himself, there's the rules of the street.
Yeah.
But then I was able to persuade him, and I'll never forget this, because he says, "All right, I'll do it." He said, "But I just want you to know, if you lose, I'm going to be at the courthouse steps waiting for him to get out, and then I'm going to and he used profanity,
yeah.
But basically said I'm going to shoot him.
Yeah.
But it was he used colorful gang language to describe what he was going to do to my defendant, and I remember walking away just like, it added the pressure, but But to your point, it's a similar idea where you go to them. And instead of us sitting in our ivory tower and say, come to my office and talk, you go to them and you put yourself in a vulnerable position and make them comfortable. Then they begin to trust you.
Pierre Richard Prosper is with us, lawyer, former L.A. County District Attorney, former war crimes prosecutor in the aftermath of the Rwanda genocide. He's joining us here in the studio. We need to take another quick break, but we'll come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Pierre Richard Prosper is joining us today. We're talking about, well, he has an amazing life, and so we're getting him to tell stories about it. I want to ask you about getting over what you saw in Rwanda, mm-hmm. or Los Angeles for that matter. Did it take a while? Do you ever really get over? You know, because you talked about the effect you had on your soul, and I wondered what you meant by that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not sure it's something you get over. I think you process and you use. But I do remember, you know, some I guess vivid moments, particularly after coming back from Rwanda. I went back to Los Angeles before I moved to D.C., and I just remember having, you know, no energy. I remember for basically, you know, several months, I would sleep until 10:30, wake up, have lunch, you know, take a nap, go out, take another nap, and then I'd be in bed by 8:30 at night. And that went on. And I remember going to the doctor saying, I must have some strange disease, you know, Ebola or whatever it was. And they ran all sorts of tests. And the doctor said, look, you know, you're healthy, but just listen to your body. You're dealing with, you know, your own trauma from what you saw. And so that's a specific moment. But I think what happens more to your soul and intellectually after that is I decided to take it and use it and use the experience and further it for humanity, I guess, you know. And that's something that I took when I became.
You almost have to make it useful, right? Otherwise, it just sits there.
Yeah, it'll eat away at you.
Right.
You know, you cannot have an experience like this and then go back to normal life. Yeah. You can't, because you'll feel that you a responsibility to continue to do something, and that's basically what I tried to do, and then I went back into government, and decided to take a policy position. At the end of the Clinton administration and then with President Bush, and use that experience. And in a way, by doing that, it becomes a, you know, cathartic, because you feel that there was a value for not only what you did, but what you went through.
I wonder what you learned in your experiences in Los Angeles. We're seeing these explosions of violence now. Over the past few years, we've seen protests in cities like Ferguson and Chicago and Baltimore and Dallas and San Diego. I mean, the list goes on and on. 202 black people shot by police so far this year, 258 2015. Did anything in your experience in Los Angeles, and now your desire to want to sort of think about policy and help and systems that you can, did you learn anything, do you think, that helps you think about what's going on now?
Yeah, you know, the answer is yes. And as you were asking me the question, what went through my mind is we are forgetting the lessons that we learned, you know, 20 plus years ago, because we were having the same problems back in when I was a DA. You know, we were, you know, we had the riots in L.A., and the riots were the result of Rodney King. You know, we had all sorts of things happening in the streets, the violence, and we began to look at the idea of a way of addressing it was to have community-based policing, so that the police and the community know each other, so that there's not that automatic suspicion that either arises when a police officer comes in or a person's afraid of the police. And I think we seem to be to be forgetting that, because that again was a focus for us in the aftermath of the LA riots, having to to deal with those issues. What we dealt with in LA particularly, and this is again the Rodney King example, is we had police officers that would come out from Simi Valley or whatever it is out in the suburbs, and they would come in at night and into South Central LA, Compton, and do policing. So
they knew nothing about those places.
They knew nothing. I mean, nothing. I guess they knew enough, as law enforcement, but not from born and raised there.
Yeah.
And then, I guess probably the way to look at it, even if they knew something about it, there's no ownership, because it's not theirs, right? And it's the same thing with the community to the police. There's no ownership because the police is not their police. They're outsiders coming in, and they come in at night where they're being shot at. So you can understand the fear in the police officers where every corner there's a shadow and you don't know if someone's going to shoot you or not. You can understand that, but it creates such a tension in these communities that it's bound to explode. You're bound to either have a police officer shoot someone or someone shoot a police officer. So we have to come back to this understanding of community-based policing. And one last point on this. I'll never forget when I was a DA, I had a good friend. His name's Kevin Burrell, black Compton police officer. He pulled a car over. He and his partner pulled a pickup truck. I remember it was a red pickup truck because I had to look at the photos. Just a routine traffic stop. In Compton, they start walking up to the car, and these two gangbangers just open the door and then gun them down. And this happens, and this officer was from Compton too. He was born and raised in Compton. But what it creates is it creates this mindset for all those other officers that now every black person, whatever it is a threat. And we tried to combat that. And again, so I know I'm repeating myself, but we have to get back to some sort of community-based engagement and policing.
Pierre Richard Prosper joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Emily Anderson is our intern. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.